The talk today is about reimagining masculinity for the small screen, male beauty in Korean historical TV dramas. Thank you very much. Let's give a round of applause. Thank you, Andy.
Thanks, Andy. We're known as the English mafia in Australia because we all graduated from the UK. So thanks so much for inviting me to give this talk today. And I was asked to talk something about TV, and I've been working on masculinities quite a lot lately. I was trained as a critical theory and literature scholar, and then I've also done cultural sociology quite a lot. So it's quite fun combining all of those, my academic disciplines together, and I've done some work on masculinities on TV screens. So this is just kind of another one of those projects. I've worked a lot on sociology of the body and kind of aesthetics, K-pop aesthetics on screen. So this is kind of riffing off on that, and also on a project that I did with Laura Miller, who's a Japanese studies scholar and who's looking at similar kind of thing in Japanese pop culture. So in 1998, when my father-in-law, Hwang Moksanim, and I would sit down in the office room to watch the latest episode of the long-running historical TV drama, Tears of the Dragon. I was learning Korean at Yonsei University. I was exhausted after a busy Sunday. I sang in Songade, and I was the resident-friendly foreigner in Yeonggunpo. And I was also quite tired from everyone speaking really fast and lots of chipsanims trying to remember their names. So it was quite frankly very ready to go to bed. But my father-in-law loved saga historical TV dramas, and he felt it was really important that I should learn about Korean history. So there I sat every Sunday watching with my father-in-law, learning Korean history through it. And as we'd watch, I admit I couldn't quite follow all the twists and turns. I'd sometimes ask him questions about Korean history and why he was so into TV dramas. And he said that in addition to teaching you truths about Korean history, historical dramas were the best way to learn politics of a large organization. And then he goes, "See, that's what happens when you don't finish the job," he'd say, pointing at the screen. "If you want to take down the king, make sure you take off his head in clean sweep." And I should mention, of course, he was a pastor, so I've sometimes wondered which Jangnonim he was thinking about when he said that. But it stayed with me. It's a quite useful lesson for university politics. So take notes next time you're watching Sagak. So in this talk, my focus is on masculinities in Korean historical TV dramas. And I hope to achieve two things through this talk. So firstly, I'll outline and illustrate the development of what Laura Miller has called historically hot masculinity. So people who look fine on screen in popular Korean historical TV drama sets in Joseon Dynasty or earlier. And when we talk about historically hot, it refers to a contemporary reimagining of historical characters and aesthetics to appeal to both domestic and international audiences. So my first aim here is to illustrate how this embodied cultural representations of Korean masculinities are set in real imagined or reimagined historical pasts, whether they're markedly fantastical or not, and how they're rendered easily consumable by transnational audiences through the deployment of a now widely recognizable K-pop stage aesthetic, which some people have referred to soft masculinity, which I have a slight problem with. But there's also a kind of representations of more mature masculinity of a middle-class man. Secondly, and reflecting on the increasingly gentle, or what some have called soft aesthetic of male lead characters, I'll also illustrate how the producers of these TV dramas create characters who are both visually pleasing to both younger and female audiences in general, in ways that leave the structures of Korean hegemonic masculinity intact. So there's quite a lot of talk about shifts in kind of the representation of kind of the phallocentric symbolic order, if we want to go post structuralist. I want to show that these structures are very much left well and truly alive, as Tagaq really works to uphold so-called traditional ideas and patriarchal structures rather than challenge them, despite the aesthetic presented. Also, I have to point out, I'm not here to also comment on the historical accuracy of any of the costuming, as that's not that's not really my area of expertise. Okay, it's not working. There we go. You click twice. Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, you're just like speeding ahead. So there we go. So really, what I'm talking about is not the kind of authenticity. So if you're really looking for authentic images of Korean historical kind of upper class men, that's really what you're talking about. So less of this and more of this. Thank you. Okay. Or this kind of thing. So now Sagak, the genre of Sagak is increasingly openly, if it hasn't always been so, it's inhabiting a fantasy space where historical accuracies are really secondary. And the joy of feasting one's eyes on the beautiful, pristine mise-en-scène takes priority. And that's not, I'm just not talking about the characters, but also the kind of landscapes and palace and so forth. And what makes these historical dramas important objects of cultural analysis is that the past is often used to justify existing structural inequalities in society. And the Sagak are certainly not holding back on emphasizing what some refer to as kind of traditional gender roles. So they really work to reinforce these structures. Popular cultural representations of masculinity are very powerful because they signal what kinds of masculinities are considered valid or not valid in a given cultural context. And as such, this kind of soft facial aesthetic of the recent Sagak representations would seem to suggest a radical break from previous representational past of militarized masculinities. However, when we start digging into the kind of plot and how characters act and behave towards each other, we find that there's a re-emphasis of the similar kind of narrative structure of emphasizing very militarized Korean masculinity. And I feel like my nose is going to start running because I'm just coming out of a terrible cold. So sorry about the voice as well. So I just want to take you on a little, okay, it's not working again. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm going to manically sniff. Okay, this is the fantasy world. So what I'm going to take you now through is the kind of development of the aesthetic. So those of you who haven't watched the original TV dramas, there is actually a long history of Sagak TV dramas in Korea. And originally, these representations of Sagak masculinities were quite heavily policed. So they focused on imagined historical accuracy, which also fitted very well in the emerging arc of narrative of nation under the cultural policies of Park Chung-hee. And the first Korean Sagak drama actually aired as early as in 1962. It's very different to the dramas today, Kukthomalli. And it was very much aligned to teaching viewers about Korean history. The genre itself was not exactly designed to be a hot export product. It consisted typically of very long, slow-moving plots of hundreds of episodes and very much focused on palace politics, and the imagined audiences were very much thought to be male. One of the first running Sagaks was Joseon Wangjo 500, which is here. I don't know if anyone's seen this one. No? Anyone? No, it's like, I'm not that old. So this is actually from 1980s. It ran for 8 years. I just want to show you a very short clip, if you just press that one. So you get a bit of a sense of what this early sagak genre looked like.
성공과 내시들은 어짜여 아직도 세자라는 소리를 입에 담느냐? 명나라로부터 책봉 고명을 받지 못한 것은 세자일 수 없음이니라. 세자가 아닌 것이 무슨 연유로 문안을 든다더냐? 세자의 문안을 폐하라. 문안을 폐하렸다.
선조는 자신의 입으로 광해군을 세자가 아니라고 했고 상궁과 내시들에게도 세자로 부르지 말라고 했으며 세자의 문안을 폐하라고 했다. 이 말도 되지 않는 선조의 변덕으로 대궐은 숨소리도 낼 수가 없었다.
저 오늘 하루만이라도 문을 걸으시니 오를
줄 아옵니다. Yeah, I think that's enough. So, but you get an idea that the production quality is not super high. There's even the microphone sound you can hear when it stand up. You can hear the boom. You know, and so there is not a huge amount of money available to produce these, and they're not exactly sort of. There's not very many TV programs on TV at this point, but they're not very particular interest to broad domestic audiences, particularly younger ones, particularly because they were more like documentaries rather than these kind of cliffhanger things that you see these days. Now, this changes in 1996. Oh, there we go. This changes in 1996 when Tears of Dragon airs on KBS for 2 years. It had 159 episodes. It reached audience levels of 49% at its peak, and it was the first true TV hit set in a pivotal turning point of Koryo and Joseon dynasties. The visual landscape was very different to this contemporary one that you see in Sagak, where you often see a lot of lush surrounds and beautiful sceneries from, you know, I don't know, Gyeongsangnam-do or somewhere lovely. But the focus is very much on close-ups on the main lead characters and the very much masculine aesthetic. So there's a lot of testosterone in this particular series. You can actually watch it. Any of these KBS ones, you can still find them. So you can Google them and they're available for free to watch if you're into watching 159 episodes of Tears of Dragon. That said, so the production cost was much higher. You can see the costuming is much sort of lusher, and the sartorial choices are much more well put together. But this said, much of the popularity of this series was attributed to its male lead, Yu Dong-eun, at this time. So his star power was really that drew a lot of audiences and increasingly female audiences as well. So this sort of gave a little bit of indication or it propelled the TV producers to think about the potential that Sagak could have. So this drama was soon followed by, okay, it's not working again, by others that developed this kind of strong narrative arc that would allow the audiences to better connect with the main character. So I don't know if you've noticed, but in a lot of Sagak, there's sort of like do do do, like close, and then you always have a kind of dramatic moment where there's like a tear, sort of, you know, and it's really extreme close-ups, and that's intentional, you know. And of course, it takes time, so you don't have to shoot as many things, and it's cheaper to do it, but it also adds to that kind of dynamic with the audiences. So founder Wang Gon, it had 200 episodes, ran from 2000 to 2002, and it focused on the story of Koryo dynasty, and it was also very popular. Again, you can see that's a screen grab from KBS free website where you can actually watch all of these, and you can see that it's very focused on the male character, right? So all of them, it really is about him. And it's very much about war, and it's about action on the war fields. So in terms of male leads in the early 2000s, many of the series presented main characters who were very heroic. So there's very much focus on this kind of Korean heroes, you know, who serve the nation in a pivotal turning point of the nation. And his focus is very much on the problems they faced politically. And there was much less kind of focus on the romantic entanglement. So it really is about lessons for your faculty meetings rather than about romantic things. So, and very much in line on the kind of idea of militarized masculinity and what the real man should do. And so if the representations of masculinity on the small screen were in some sense, you know, ideal, kind of military heroes, but also troubled because of their role as a leader rather than for other reasons. The genre did allow for experimenting with more varied action scenes as well, which was quite good for the development of Korean TV screen scenes. But it really, this genre was owned by kind of middle-aged armchair historians watching the series at home. So it didn't have a huge reach, particularly overseas. And there were apparently a lot of complaints about perceived inaccuracies in the where they were detected. And then with Winter Sonata in 2002, there was a slight shift. When Winter Sonata introduced this kind of more sensitive male character, which immediately resonated with female audiences home and abroad, it actually took a little while longer for them to appear in Sagak. And there's probably a couple of reasons for this. One is that it wasn't really intended for female audiences as such, you know. It also made it contentious to think about representations of Korean history from perspective other than kind of heroic military exploits and the kind of sort of strong hyper-masculine, militarized masculinity. Now, Taejang-geum, if I can change the slide. Nope, thank you. Taejang-geum, 2000 and Jewel in the Palace, I think it's translated as, marked another shift in this sagak genre on the small screen. The narrative was focused less on historical accuracy, so roughly historical characters, and more on the character development and women's plight in particular. So here you have very much focus on women and visual pleasure. So Taejang-geum has got these amazing sets, and also it has that lush background. And it also introduced another layer to the sagak, which is Taejang-geum as the set as a tourist destination. So this is where we actually see for the first time kind of reaching out quite unintentionally at first of Korean sagak overseas. And I'm just reflecting on the previous session, which some of you weren't at, but it's almost a similar kind of as boys' love sort of is often driven through the overseas interest and the monetary kind of benefits that follows. So while the focus of this particular drama was on the female lead and the difficulties that women experienced in feudal and patriarchal society ruled by strong social norms, the male character's aesthetic was that of a kind of middle-aged, mature man, but one who was devoted to the female character. And he was not only a scholar, but he was, of course, a swordsman. Who was gifted in that way too. So we have a secondary character, you know, supporting character who's male. And of course, even this sort of the popularity of that one also then showed to the production companies that and broadcasting companies that there was some merit to introducing main female characters. And I don't know, this you might have seen, Queen's Hondok. It's actually worth watching. If you haven't seen it, it's a really interesting TV series. Lots of 62 episodes in total, and it focuses on the Queen of Silla, Sondok. It aired from May to December 2009. And it actually introduced this character, Hwarang, or male warrior character, into its, which hinted at this new aesthetic. And also there was quite a lot of humor used and cross-dressing and use of makeup. So this is new for Sagak. And what was useful and or probably gave an opportunity for the producers and the dress designers in particular was that we actually don't know that much about the Hwarang. So we know they were seen as these flower warriors, and they had, we know that something about their values and so forth, but we don't really know much about what they looked like. So there was this opportunity to imagine what they might have looked like. So there's no surprise here that the one of the main characters, this guy here, is plays so Om Tae-wong, he plays Kim Yu-shin. And one of the things about these Sagak TV dramas that you still see is that there are certain characters you don't touch. You don't take too much artistic license with them. So Kim Yu-shin is one of them. He's the reliable, heroic, handsome character who's there to support and never let down the queen. But then you have this new character, Bidam, who's played by Kim Nam-gil, and he is kind of this new conflicted, slightly, but a very handsome character who is decisively athletic, he kind of fails in his doomed love for the male-female character. But there's a lot of, in this particular TV drama, you know, that I feel like it was very much a turning point in experimenting more on the aesthetic that the men could do or wear on screen. So really the Hwarang here were very fertile ground for reimagining masculinity that was supportive of female power and what that might look like, both visually and also in terms of narrative arc. So for that reason alone, if you haven't watched it, it's quite interesting, because of course, it being a historical TV drama, it's still a historical TV drama for contemporary audiences. So it allows a kind of fantasy space to really think about what female power, successful female power might look like. Now we come to Chuno, if we can go to the next slide. Yep, there we go. So Chuno is another one. This is a TV drama that really took a perspective of a kind of not just Yangban and palace TV dramas, but it also followed these slave hunters, the Chuno. It took the fighting scenes against lush natural backdrop to a whole new level. Fighting scenes in rivers and like slow motion and a lot of rippling muscle. And it in many ways celebrated the power and beauty of lower class male bodies, or the kind of fallen Yangban kind of bodies. And really it kind of, before this, you haven't really seen any of this sort of ripping off. And it's similar kind of timeline to when you see K-pop stars like Rain start doing this on stage. So Chuno was one of the first historical TV dramas to show these male bodies topless. And Chang Hyuk in particular, I think that's become his trademark now, that he's the brooding kind of and very much focusing on hyper-masculinity of these main characters. So considering that the male body is, as Todd Reason notes, the most common purveyor of masculinity, it's hardly surprising that the focus on male characters' emotions was counterbalanced by the reveal of their upper torso. So these are guys who are sensitive and they even cry, but then we are reassured of their full masculinity through this revealing of their bodies in their full glory. And also there's something else about this drama that marks these bodies as authentically Korean bodies. So there's something about the narrative of Koreanness about this as well. And I wanted to add this sort of ink drawing picture here. In the opening scenes of this TV drama, you can see these paintings which are done with the ink, like a put. And it's almost like a painting, and it's very kind of traditional Korean style. The music as well in this particular drama uses a lot of Korean traditional instruments, which really emphasizes that this is kind of like an authentic Korean narrative. So this is like the original Chin Seung-nam, and also the beastly man. But interestingly, while male bodies are on display, female bodies are not really on display. So as you can see in this image, there was a scene where, you know, she's this main female character is being helped by a male character, and her like chogori, like top is being, haven't been taken off, and it was blurred. So because it was felt that it was too sexy, you know, to show this. Of course, now you can see it. And then, of course, what happened as a result is that everybody noticed it was blurred. So it kind of drew more attention to the fact that it was blurred, and everyone's thinking, what's underneath? But I want to show you a scene. Next slide? No, next slide. No, next slide. Yeah, just skip that one. Yeah, here, this is better size. So this is a first in Sagak TV dramas, and if you click on it, it's pretty self-explanatory.
놔주려고 삶았어, 주모?
아유, 이 천하의 잡념 같은 일하고. 왜 떨어질 뻔했네, 그냥.
Yep. So as you can see, not much is left to imagination there. And it's very much kind of, there's a shift. And this is acceptable, of course, because these are kind of peasant bodies, and but very much on display. So what you now see is this shift from towards less accurate representations, or the kind of insistence that historical sagak have to be 100% according to what historians have sort of recorded. So you can so there's a lot of these less accurate historical narratives then began to appear in the second decade of the 2000s, 2010s, such as fantasy time traveling, with K-pop idols as displaced princes, learning about gender equality and love, such as in Rooftop Prince in 2012. And so dramas now start using a lot of K-pop idols or younger stars, actors who look like K-pop stars. And this really resulted growth in both domestic and overseas audiences. And this, I think, really helped to propel sagak into an international success story. So the inauthenticity was less of an issue now, because the historical now intersects with the fantastical. So this is fantasy history drama, and so you don't have to worry. But again, you see that King Sejong never appears in these ones. So there are certain characters from the history who never seem to appear in these kind of fantasy sagak. So sagak are now increasingly hybrid. They draw on elements of supernatural, both in Korean and other fantasy genres. There's zombies, there's goblins, there's nine-tailed foxes, there's spirits, ghosts, grim reapers, wizards, and they all kind of funnily sit under the sagak genre. Costuming is used increasingly effectively to highlight the fantasy element of the supernatural narratives rather than teach people or their audiences about the past. So these days, it's more unusual to see a sagag that tries to be historically accurate than the other way around. But often the fantasy aspect of it is very much signaled through the costuming. So if the costuming is a bit shoo, then you know that there's some fantasy coming. So sagag masculinities does represent very much present rather than the past. They reflect masculinities in Korea today as projected to domestic and foreign audiences through this kind of dialogic between imagined past, where women have no rights at all, and the present, where historical characters learn about the benefits of equality and discover that intelligent women are in fact quite attractive, which is nice. So really, and I think finally, there we go. Okay. So the young male aesthetic has also shifted more towards colorful celebration of the male body with plenty of extreme close-ups of their faces and hwarang. Oh, you put it up. Excellent. So hwarang again, if you look at the costuming here, and I said I wasn't going to talk about the fashion, but this is by all accounts, it's probably very historically inaccurate. But it's very good to look at. So the way how it sits. So I've spoken to a cosplay colleague who just finds this so attractive for cosplayers. So it's really much focused on what attracts the eye. So hwarang, which came out in 2016, is a good example how little known past is intertwined with contemporary K-pop stage aesthetic. With contemporary visual representation to create this fantastic representation of hwarang, who essentially resemble a K-pop band in a docu-soap. So if you click it once more, there should be a... Yeah, there you go. So it's sold to overseas audiences. I mean, this is really very much a kind of the way in which you would expect a band to stand together and kind of hint at things. So this was really a full package focused on showcasing male beauty and playing with fashion. And the fact that hwarang were supposed to be known for their good looks gave a full artistic permission to do this. A cast included Park Hyung-sik as well, who's a K-pop star. And it also unabashedly utilized the recognizable flower boy or gomminam appeal to traditional audiences. And it was very successful. So what this one does quite effectively is that it actually it's one of the sagags that is using the technique used in K-pop fandoms in minimizing the distance between the, so you know, we call it parasocial kind of relationship, you know, where the audiences already know some of the band members because they are fans of these characters. So immediately, you know, they imagine them in these fantastical historical pasts, and you enter this fantasy land as a fan and you feel close to the character. None of them ever die as a result, I guess, because they need to survive. So, you know, it adds emotional kind of connection to these characters, and that then helps to reduce the distance of otherwise unfamiliar surrounds in the first instance, such as the ancient Silla kingdom. So everyone feels, oh, this is my hood now. Me too, I can experience Silla. So Kim and O'Connor note that this combination between place, character, and celebrity play quite an important part in the planning and production of a successful sagag. So it's an intentional thing, place, character, celebrity. And they note that further that personal attachment to the characters mediated through this fan attachment influences attitudes towards the location where the drama takes place to allow the viewers to, quote, experience virtual traveling and to escape from their bounded locality and reach out to their outside world in a playful, enjoyable, and relaxing way, end of quote. So this kind of virtual travel to Korea and Korea's past also creates a sense of familiarity with the place and promotes a desire for the fans to visit these places, and not just any Korea, This is not just soul. This is a career where men are sensitive, they learn empathy, and they look good. So male bodies too are spectacles here against these backgrounds, allowing creation what Kim Yeri so aptly calls sensory luxury, made familiar through this deployment of K-pop aesthetic. So they also often portray upper classes. It's almost exclusively. So you find that a lot of the characters who are not so attractive are either villains still or they are lower classes. So K-pop aesthetic nowadays in Sagak marks the characters out as the ones who are on their way on upward kind of trajectory. So these characters hardly undermine existing masculine ideologies that valorizes power, status, strength, and homosocial loyalty as well. So next. Click. Okay. So really, there's not a very much like a demasculinization of Korean masculinity one can detect, as you can tell, from these sagas. In fact, in these imagined past, the Joseon or earlier masculinity is very much played up. Kind of images of the past, perceived maybe historical failures, are reborn on the screen, and they're both rooted in the authentic past and also appearing modern and cosmopolitan for the contemporary viewer. So very much shift has happened in this kind of underlying patriarchal symbolic, since the Tears of the Dragon, maleness in Sagok is performed through dress, even more overtly, I think, these days than in other contexts. And foreign and domestic audiences alike are taught that upper class costumes are emblematic of dominance and class. So the use of, I don't know if you noticed that, but the use of kind of yangban attire is also used very effectively here. How am I doing with time? 5 more minutes. Okay, so I can then cover this one, because I also wanted to say that there are some things that have shifted slightly. So these are the joys of historical inaccuracy. So increasingly, I think it's because potentially there's only so many storylines in the history that you can find. So the joys of historical inaccuracy in these sagas is very few people actually complain about them, but there is very little, like I said, maneuvering space where the real characters are concerned. So I seem to have lost one slide, but it was the previous one. Sorry, previous slide. It's kind of awkward when you can't do this. So this Puri Kippon Namo, which is about Sejong, King Sejong, there is, thank you. So there's very little maneuvering space in his narrative arc. He's just an utterly good character throughout this thing. But if you have Hoim, who's a famous, what are they called? Like Tim. Acupuncturist, yeah. If he goes time traveling, he can do all sorts of fun stuff, you know, even though he's a real character. And then, of course, now I don't know how to use this because I have. There we go. Okay, sorry. Technology difficult. And then, but there are some interesting things, like, for example, Mr. Queen. Which allows for a kind of reimagining of gender roles. So Mr. Queen, I don't know if anyone's seen it here, but basically it's a kind of time traveling story and gender bending story where a man somehow finds himself in a contemporary character, finds himself in the body of a Joseon queen. And then falls in love with the king. So he kind of is sort of asking the questions of same-sex love through the safe premise of being in a female body. There's also these kinds of new wizardy spaces, which are just don't even pretend to be Sagok, really. They're just, as you can see, the costuming is not really even Korean. But what you have is everyone's just incredibly beautiful. So it's really about the Koreanness of this is not really even important. It's not even set in any kind of real historical past. It's almost like Game of Thrones, but with magic things. And even more so, and I'm going to finish with this one. If I can change the... is this Chronicles of Arendal, which had quite an interesting premise. You know, it kind of imagined this pre-modern space before Joseon Dynasty, before Korea, before this kind of history starts, and pre-kind of confusion sort of state. So what you have here is the potential for a narrative storyline that could be anything. You know, it could be matriarchal society, right? But what it ends up being, sorry, this is, you can close your ears now if you want to watch this. But it's a complete party blooper from a narrative perspective, especially as a kind of feminist scholar, is that it really just does a weird Game of Thrones. Sorry if you're a massive fan of this. It sort of does like a Korean Game of Thrones where it reimagines this ancient history, but ends up reproducing all of the kind of social structures. So you have strong but handsome male characters and a lot of stars that you recognize. That's, what's his name, Nick Chun? From 2 p.m. or 2 a.m. Can't remember which one. But he's literally a Neanderthal in this one. So there's like, he has a super masculine, like her power in it. So... yeah, so it's very much reinforcing foundation myths and their connections to presumed truths about masculinity tied in ideas of leadership, power, masculinity, and violence, a lot of violence, and warfare, and the absolute need to take off your enemy's head before yours comes off, and how the power lies in the hands of men who are not just men, but also almost like cavemen. Neanderthal. So it seems like the university administrator logic still applies. Sorry, that's like inside joke. And that's it. Thank you.